All right. Good morning, Wednesday, live here on the Gareth Cliff Show, The Real Network. And you're here with me and with Jack Montlante.
Good morning.
Good morning, comrade.
How are you, comrades? Did you have a good weekend, Chief?
But the weekend is long ago. But we've got a nice long weekend coming up this week.
Yes, sir.
Thank you, ladies, for being ladies, a thing you had no choice in.
Yeah.
You were born as women and you get Friday off. But guess what? We do too. So we're not complaining. So happy Women's Day to everybody in South Africa who celebrates that public holiday on Wednesday. Mm. It's just about the only thing in August that makes August tolerable with the wind and the cold and the everything else.
Yeah. So. I mean, if it's almost interesting, given the fact that most women wear skirts, August is the worst month.
That's not a good
You know what I mean? To celebrate women, I think that's a travesty. But nonetheless, they decided to march to the union buildings in August. So,
Well, good for them. Yeah. You know, they didn't let that stop them.
Exactly. It's fantastic.
Sophie and all those ladies. Mm-hmm. Sophie De Beer. What was it? Yeah. Something. Anyway. So it is a Wednesday, and that means we've got lots to get to. We're going to talk to the authors of a great book just now. And for all those people who love the killers, the serial killers, the murderers, the CSI stuff, all of that stuff, it's fantastic. We've got two amazing people coming in to talk to us about South African serial murderers. Ooh. And we have a lot of them, sadly. I don't know if that's something we should be proud of, but we've got so much in this country that Nicole Engelbrecht and Bryn Hodgkiss have been able to write a book about it. And we're going to find out all about that. So that should keep you glued to what you are currently watching or listening to. Mm-hmm. We also have a little discussion later on about conscious leadership. So I think this will be interesting because, you know, you got a lot of people talking about what it's like to run companies, what it's like to run governments, businesses, families, whatever else it might be. And the word leadership has been so bastardized by so many people.
Similar to genius.
Yeah, I think there are so many people who occupy offices all over the world, but are not leaders. So I think it's really worth getting into what the difference is.
Mm-hmm.
That, for me, is an interesting subject, and I hope it will be for you as well a little bit later on. We'll speak to Dr. Pepe Marais, who, of course, is the co-founder of Joe Public. We'll also speak to Gareth Van Vuren, who's the founder of Wrapped Creative. And we've got lots of interesting things to unpack with them later on. We've got some news to get to. We're going to talk about where swear words come from. Jack has been doing his research, you know, because we use them so often on this show that we
thought we
may as well figure out where the hell they're from.
And truthfully, I was a little bit annoyed at how sensitive people are to these four-lettered words.
People are hugely sensitive.
Sure.
I mean, it used to be just like grannies. And believe me, it comes up all the time because on this show, we are not forced to comply with broadcasting standards, which I did for a whole 20 years, 15 to 20 years of my career. And I managed perfectly well. I didn't feel hemmed in by it. Yeah. I didn't think, and you know, my least favorite criticism of people who swear is, you just don't have a very good vocabulary. I'm like, no, actually, I've managed very well to not swear for most of my career. The fact that I do in my private life is not a lack of vocabulary. It's the opposite. It's that sometimes the best word for something
precisely
is
that.
Fuck.
Yes.
You know?
Precisely that. And like, there's different ways in which you can explain something to someone or express something to someone. Like if I say to you, Gareth, I think it's time you put your life together, that doesn't hit the same as, dude, you need to get your shit together. You know what I mean?
Right.
Sometimes you just have to get it out.
I always wonder what those terribly suitable people who don't swear do when they are hammering a nail into a wall and it hits their thumb by me. I mean, I know the expletives just roll out of me, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I wonder what like some very suitable, very community-oriented, church-going, decent human being says when that hammer smacks into their thumb.
Oh,
do they go, good heavens.
Yeah. Oh, my gosh,
What do they say? And if they do manage to, in that moment, be as composed as to not allow themselves to swear, then I congratulate them on that.
Yeah, it's actually pretty commendable.
Sure. Mm. I woke up this morning and had a fun fight with a socialist at like 4:40, which is always the best way to wake up. Somebody I've never met before like starts going at me about stuff I've been posting on. I mean, I thought the point of posting what you think and saying what is on your mind. That's one of the reasons to have social media.
Yeah.
I'm not doing it because I want to curry favor with anybody or because I could care less if you follow me or not. But if you are following me, hopefully the reason you're following me is because you are interested in what I'm thinking. Anyway, this guy, I don't know, he must have been like stewing all night or whatever, but I found this message in my inbox about American politics and how wrong I am about the Democrats and how Kamala Harris is just marvelous and Joe Biden is totally lucid and the new VP pick, guy called Waltz, he's just fantastic, even though this guy who's writing this to me knows nothing about this dude from...
So this person just decided to wake up and lie.
Well, I decided to tell him that I thought, without knowing anything about him, he's probably... He lives in London. It says in his bio, closet socialist. So I'm not putting any label on him that he hasn't put on himself.
Hmm.
But this is the kind of person who you don't need to start your day with that person.
That's why I'm wondering why you gave him a moment of your time.
I replied. I said, you know what? It's not my fault that reality is brushing up against what you consider to be like virtues and that you're losing on that front. And I blocked him. I know it's very petty, but I don't need to fill my day with misery. And if he wants really to, I mean, I could choose violence, but I've chosen not to have any of that. So I got out of that one nicely, arrived here, got a nice cup of coffee, ready to start my day. We had to talk about serial killers, murderers, the real problem. And then I see it's not just me who's having to put up with this stuff. Poor old Gayton McKenzie. I mean, I don't know why, but it seems like all the people I really loathe and detest online hate Gayton McKenzie. So that makes me like him more.
Mm.
Yeah, it's like there are two people at the moment who are a good litmus test for me. If you really hate Gayton McKenzie in South Africa, because he's one of those people who speaks his mind.
Sure.
I don't agree with everything Gayton says. I also have my misgivings about some of the stuff he talks about. And there are occasions where I go, ooh. But by virtue of the fact that he actually says what he thinks, he's not doing what everybody else on the internet seems to do a lot of the time, which is to lie to see if they can be popular.
Sure.
I like that about him. So Richard Poplack, who used to be a journalist, said, Gayton McKenzie is a dumb prick and he should never have been made a cabinet minister, which first of all is just great for journalism because, you know, we're told the Fourth Estate is so necessary and it's such an important bulwark against, you know, the abuse of power and freedom of information and all of these things. That to me is just such a powerful, you know, summation of so much of what's going on around us. It's such a great indicator of how journalists are above the fray. They don't get personal. Of course, I'm being as sarcastic as I can possibly be, because for you to say someone is a dumb prick is not adding any value to the conversation, but I don't need to point that out because Richard Poplack lost his mind a long while ago. I used to have him on the show all the time.
Yeah.
Now, I think better for him to go to a mental hospital. Anyway, Gayton said, one day when I'm no longer a minister, I shall answer you. Now, you know what that means.
Yeah.
I'm going to fuck you up.
Yeah.
Right? And I'd like to see that fight. I actually would like to see that fight.
We're going to meet up on Saturday morning.
As someone who is pro-free speech and doesn't like government, and since Gayton's now a government minister, doesn't like government abuse of people, he's doing the right thing. He's like, one day when I'm no longer a minister,
but it's let's just have this chat again.
Man to man,
yeah.
Then we can have that fight. But right now, he says, I will abide by the code of conduct for ministers. That's a perfect answer, right?
Can you imagine?
I wish you all the best in going around calling people dumb pricks. Salute.
Now, that is, I almost said it's a thinly veiled threat, but it's not veiled at all.
Nah.
It's and like,
it doesn't come from, like, Gayton's not going around trying to upset precious journalists in ivory towers.
Yeah.
He's just responding to a mean and unnecessary personal attack from somebody who obviously has a gripe with him that has nothing to do with his job as a minister or his policy.
Yeah, but I mean, look, we live in the world of clickbait and social media craze. So everyone wants to be trending in some shape or
just
form.
Just by the way.
Like, people look for relevance that way.
I do want to defend Richard Poplack's right to say someone's a dumb prick.
Yeah, sure.
It's fine. But then if there are consequences, it's not my fault.
Because
that's what people say. That's what people say when they're not pro free speech advocates, right? Mm-hmm. When they don't like free speech, they go, yeah, there've got to be consequences, and everything that I don't agree with must be hate speech. I'm like, no, well, not really, but there are consequences. Yes.
There's always consequences.
In fact, anybody who is going to go on social media this morning and say what they think, or who's going to join us in the comments section, which is a vile and terrible place, then I welcome you. But there will be consequences. Like, we will call you out for terrible comments in the comments section.
Yeah.
And better be ready. Ooh, I tell you, it's going to be so much fun.
Listen, everyone's fair game. I've also been checking out some of the comments on the clips that we post from the show and stuff.
Oh, yeah?
Hey, let me tell you something.
You shouldn't do that.
No, let me tell you something. All of these people that claim to... So the worst kind of people that I've come across are the ones that always espouse to how kind and nice they are as human beings.
Oh, yeah.
And it's like, how? What happened to the niceness, guy? What happened? It seems you're actually showing who you really are.
No, it's
this entire time you're just virtue signaling.
It's like a total lack of self-awareness.
I think they know exactly what they're doing.
See,
it's a bait and switch. Like, you know how this is a terrible example, but I'll use it.
So you see, you're saying that they're self-conscious frauds.
Yes.
Okay.
That's exactly what they're doing.
Okay.
It's like those white panel vans that drive around trying to give kids sweets. They're like, no, I'm just trying to make the kids happy. But no, we know exactly what you're doing. You're just a disgusting human being. That's what it is. And the fact that you can hide behind your avatar and you think you are anonymous. In fact, Monday's show was a great indication of how, whether you like it or not, you're not that anonymous. We can hunt you down and find you.
Oh, yeah. You're talking about Brent Lindekew.
Yeah.
Brent Lindekew was on the show on Monday, and he's been stalked by someone who he didn't know from a hole in the ground.
Mm-hmm.
On social media, this person was like vituperative and mean and nasty and vicious and made death threats and all kinds of things. So he said, cool, I'm going to get a lawyer. And they went to this little prick's house, and he like lives in his mother's basement, as we could have predicted. And he's been served with an interdict. And if he tries to contact him again, then he'll be arrested and go to jail. What did he do? He burst into tears.
Of course.
Which is what always happens.
Of course. So, whenever you stand up to a bully, that's typically what happens.
Raven points out something I think is really worthy of discussion. And I don't know if we're going to have time for this today, but toxic positivity is a manipulation tactic.
Yes, sir.
And there is such a thing as an abundance, a dangerous abundance of compassion too.
Yeah.
We don't talk about that enough, but it is a feature. Actually, it's a bug. It's a bug, not a feature, of modern society, that people who are overly compassionate or present themselves as overly compassionate, because they're not really like that. They don't actually care about anyone but themselves, are actually doing huge damage to society.
Yep.
They're the sort of people who will say, we must stop hate. And you're like, there are some things that it's absolutely right to hate.
Yeah.
You know, like child molesters. I mean, I really hate child molesters, and I don't care who knows it.
And you actually don't have to think twice about it.
Fat people. I mean, I really do, and I don't care who knows it.
Okay, I'm going to step away from that one. I'd say if you are obese, think about your life choices.
Don't go that way.
Think about your life choices.
You know what, James? Edit that whole part out of the show. All right, so in the comments section, a couple of interesting things here. First of all, Bakabantu is back in the comments section.
Hey, BQ,
welcome
what's
back.
Happening?
Good to see you. And then I see somebody says we had a five earthquake. So it's 5 on the Richter scale a couple of nights ago in Wellington. That's interesting. That's in New Zealand.
Oh.
From Raven, yeah. I also see this. The word journalist should be used very carefully. They're mostly clickbaiters, copy and pasters, and Twitter researchers, from Tracy. Yes. I mean, look, I will say I used to really, really like a lot of what Richard used to write. And he was kind of a bit gonzo. You know, Hunter S. Thompson vibes. It was fun to read. And I think he still has that. I just don't understand how like this mad detestation of a certain kind of politics throws people off of where their talents lie.
Mm.
Like, I'm not a journalist, right? I've never been a journalist. I didn't study journalism. I don't report the news. I am an entertainer, so I don't have to comply with these strictures that are put in place by people like Anton Harbor. But you do if you're a journalist. And if that's how you want to be, then those are the rules that you've set up for yourself. And you can't then get upset when the rest of us call you out for being, for speaking with forked tongue. It just doesn't, it doesn't reflect well on you. There's a pendulum swing, says Bakabantu, with disagreeing that leaves you to arguing for the other side, whether you believe it or not. The trappings of being against you just end up being for, and okay, then it cuts off. Sorry, that was a stupid thing to read. Makes no sense at all.
Yeah, I was trying to figure out what was going on there. But I like the fact that he used the term pendulum. Like, it's so interesting how the court of public opinion kind of sways in one direction. Like, it's similar to, you know, the idea that if you're standing too close to the elephant, you don't see the elephant. You only just see its dick-skinned vibe. You get what I mean?
Yeah.
And the moment you step back, you'll be able to see the elephant in its entirety. So I imagine with society, given the fact that it's happening on a large scale, when something happens, we react. And then it takes a bit of a while for everyone to take a bit of a step back as one large group. So the pendulum is constantly swinging. But at this point, the over-compassionate people that you were talking about, it's a bit towards their side right now. Like, the left is kind of winning the court of public opinion at this point in time.
Yeah, and we've been presented with this fallacious argument that the person who's the most compassionate in any situation is always the one who's morally right. And that is objectively incorrect.
Yeah.
So I think what we need to do is, again, we don't have time this morning, but I think at some point in the future, it would be nice to unpack with you kind of what we think that is, this toxic compassion, this abundance, which obviously is necessary in society. You need a lot of compassion in order to raise kids, to make a family, to make society. You want a society that cares about people. You want a society where people aren't treated horrifically by each other, by government, by the institutions of state, any of that stuff. Otherwise, that would be a terrible place to live. And there are places in the world that are like that right now. The other extreme is the sort of society that cannot allow people to account for themselves because no one is wrong. Everybody deserves a chance. There isn't such a thing as being responsible because society as a whole is responsible. You know, we know these kinds of arguments. I think we can get into it another day.
Yeah.
But let's put that on pause for now. You did want to tell us about where these swear words come from. And before we get into murders, I think it's probably a good idea so we can arm ourselves with a few swear words.
So a couple of years ago, I watched Mac G interview Zola 7. And he kind of opened up my eyes to where some of these words come from. So, according to Zola 7.
Zola 7.
Yes, sir. I'll change your life in 3 days. Anyway.
No, I like Zola.
He's a great guy. So, apparently, the word shit comes from people who had to transport rubbish from one place to another. And whenever they'd have to transport that rubbish over water, they'd tell you to store it high in transit.
Really?
Yeah. So you wouldn't have to deal with the smell when you believe it, right? So if you store all of that shit,
really?
You won't have to deal with the smell. So apparently that's where the word comes from. And then F-U-C-K is fornication under consent of the king.
I feel like these things have been attributed to the words post hoc, but okay, all right.
I don't know.
Okay,
I think
was what some medieval right of droit des seigneurs.
Yeah.
Where you could basically have sex with anyone you wanted to.
Exactly. Now,
as like a terrible, like, lord of the manor, you just go around and grab a peasant woman by the hair.
And have your way with her, which is, you know, it is backwards, but it is from medieval times. So we can't really judge. But I mean, I also thought about, what's this? The word bitch.
Yeah. Where's that from?
I've been told that it's actually the correct term for a female dog. So how it came about, apparently, is they could not figure out how to separate the animals, like from male and female. And as a result, they decided to come up with this word that would describe the female.
That sounds like a crap reasoning, but okay.
Yeah, all right, I mean, these are some of the things that I came across on the internet. Mind you, my research is not thorough.
Congo,
I didn't
Chris,
go to university for this shit. Well, I just came across it on the internet.
You don't have to. It's a theory, and
it's a theory.
Much of what we do on this show is just nonsense theory. So Congo Chris says, that sounds like the worst way to transport shit.
Mm-hmm.
That bucket is going to slosh back and forth and rain down from on high. If that doesn't put you off, I don't know what will.
Yep.
Apparently, Nicolas Cage, according to Dirk Kutsier, did a special on Netflix called The History of Swear Words. It was hilarious.
Maybe I should have watched that.
I think so. Wayne also says, that clip from ages ago that explained that fuck was from the German word ficken. Yeah. Mm. And then goes on to elaborate the many beautiful uses of the word. And Bakabantu climbing in on this one. Bitch is the female name for a dog.
Okay, there you go.
Somebody told me is how you started that, according to Vyasin. That's the problem. Who's that someone, Jack?
I told you.
Yeah, Zola 7.
It's Zola 7.
Okay, well, I'm not good. You know what? Forgive. I like Zola. I think everything that Zola's done in his media career has been terrific. But when it comes to linguistics, I think I'll chat GPT this later and we'll see what we can come up with.
Listen, chat GPT is not going to help you much either. But anyway, I just thought that would be something cool to share. I came across the interview about last week, and I was thinking it was interesting to me that, number one, people have such a weird reaction to those words. And secondly, I wanted to find out where some of them came from.
All right. While we get the studio ready for these two, because we've got to get Bryn and Nicole in here with Jack, I want to chat to them both about the book that they've just written. It's called Conversations with South African Serial Murderers. This is amazing, amazing stuff. You know, we have just a plethora of these very, very dangerous people in this country. And it appears to me that there are at least two people in the world who are not scared of sitting down and speaking to them. So these are the words I'm about to read you of one of South Africa's most terrifying serial killers who spoke to psychologist Bryn Hodgkiss in the bowels of the country's most secure prisons. Hodgkiss interviewed several of the most notorious serial killers in his recordings. And Nicole Engelbrecht eventually had the gumption and the brilliance to decide to put these things down into a book, which I think is what we're going to hear about now. So I'm going to start off talking to Bryn. So first of all, you've got an amazing story here because you have worked in SA and the UK with the police on investigations tackling everything from burglary to terrorism, murder, and rape. He's published in international journals as well as presented academically on TV and radio on the subject of serial murder. Why are people so fascinated with serial murderers, Bryn?
I do not know.
Yes, you do.
But I was, you know what? It's like, for me, the journey began when I was a student.
Right.
And actually, as I say in the book, it's like standing over the body of a dead schoolgirl and had her throat cut ear to ear. And I was part of a team that was helping to consult the police on, you know, how do you profile someone who's done this?
Right.
And standing over that body, you get this amazing wave of a combination of sort of anger and motivation. I was like, actually, I can do something about this. So then when the opportunity came to say, well, actually, the South African police want to research this more, can we get a student volunteer to go into the prisons and actually interview these guys? I was like, yeah, I'm up for that.
You're very brave. I just want to read that sentence that I was going to read, and I got distracted. But these are the words of one of South Africa's most terrifying serial killers, right? It goes, if you made me angry, to me, for that anger to go away, I have to get hold of you. For that anger to go away, I have to do something to you. So who said that?
Well, what I've had to do in the book, because I collected this as part of psychological research.
And kept so them anonymous?
Kept them anonymous.
Okay.
So that, I called that guy Sisanda in the book.
Mm.
And you know what was really interesting, and this is why what motivated me to write the book with Nicole called Killer Stories, is what I found as I was going from maximum security prison to maximum security prison, talking to all these guys, is the stories they told themselves about their lives starts to help create the crime and then maintain the crime.
Mm.
And so it was those stories, I think, actually, let's see elements of the stories that each guy has that then helps create the crime. And for Sasanda, like that, the quote you read out captures it wonderfully. Because
it's chilling.
It is.
And because he was telling himself the story, it was like, to be a man, he said elsewhere, he says, to be a man, I have to dominate.
Sure.
You know, so it's fine for me to have lots of girlfriends, but not fine for the girlfriends to have anyone else.
Mm.
And if I find they did, I have to do something. I have to get my hands on them. I have to hurt them.
Were there any common threads between the different subjects that you interviewed?
Yes, definitely. So like in the book, there's sort of six killer stories I drew out. But I found a lot of guys sort of almost had it as a syndrome. So they had elements of killer stories, of each other's killer stories. Mm. But one of the most common, actually, I found was a belief that they were victims of the world.
Hmm. Oh, okay, so victim mentality is a big part of it. Any common threads in terms of the way that they grew up? Because we always wonder, is a serial killer, is someone who is able to murder that, you know, more than one person? I mean, one is bad enough. But if you can commit yourself to just a string of murders,
mm.
and they do, I mean, maybe they regret things later on. I don't know about that. But is there a way that we can say that serial killers are made or that they just are?
And gosh, it would be love. If we answered that, it would be Nobel Prizes for everyone.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Because the challenge is any element you find in one person that became a serial murderer, you'd find in someone else who didn't. So, for example, you've got, you know, if you read Michael's story in the book, he had a horrifying childhood. It's almost no surprise he turned out the way he did. By contrast, Jacques, his childhood was almost the picture of banality.
Mm-hmm. Really?
You know.
Really, huh?
Absolutely.
So there's just no way to tell.
No, and it's quite a I think it's a complex interweaving between, you know, your personality, your circumstances, and then the story you tell about yourself. And then last of all, just an element of bad luck.
Before we get into more about the book, and we're going to talk to Nicole just now as well, I really want to speak to her about like the podcast she's created, because that's quite incredible. True Crime South Africa, Samurai Sword Murder, the Mornay Haramsa story, a bunch of these things. And she's also done one called Sizzlers, the hate crime that tore Sea Point apart. They're three amazing projects that she's been part of there. Was it scary for you to go into these prisons and talk to these people? I know that you probably have a greater capacity to handle these things than most people. You're fascinated by it and you're qualified and you understand it better than the rest of us. But I've been into South African prisons. They're not nice places.
Uh-uh.
We did a show from there years ago at Pretoria Central, Khosi Mampuru as it's called now. And we went into the C-Max part of it, where you've got some really terrible people. Yeah. I remember I saw Moses Sithole there, Colin Chauke.
Mm.
That was, you know, long ago, early 2000s. Then it's not a happy place. And you come out of there a little bit rattled if you're just a normal citizen.
Mm-hmm. Mm.
You willingly put yourself in there and you actually sit and talk to these guys.
Mm.
What's that like?
So, you know what, mostly, because most prisons aren't like, you know, the C-Max, Ultra Maximum. That's sort of Hannibal Lecter level prison.
Yeah.
And most of them are just sort of shabby institutional places. It's noisy and there's the smell of rolling tobacco and badly washed clothes. And mostly I'm speaking to the guys sort of most of the distance jacks away from me now. So my focus in the interviews at the time, and I was much younger, was don't screw it up.
Oh, wow.
You know, just, you know, wow. Make sure you maintain a positive, you know, maintain openness, keep the relationship going, keep the conversation going.
Mm-hmm.
And that's sort of the main focus. And it's only afterwards sometimes I realized, you know what, they weren't talking about sort of having lunch and deciding, you know, do I want hot dogs or hamburgers? They were talking about killing someone.
Yeah.
You know, and then your sort of judgment, your moral judgment, which you've had to disconnect for a second, clicks back in. You're like, that's quite heavy.
The subject matter that you were interviewing these guys about, did it make it like my mind goes to, can you even trust what they have to say? Like, if someone is willing to continuously kill people, taking them at their word or what they say at face value is tough.
Yeah. So each interview was a bit like a mini investigation.
Okay.
So, you know, I would find their case file. I would go up to investigative psychology in Pretoria and copy that out. I'd then try find the investigating officer and have a chat with him. And they were hims back in that day. So then by the time I rocked up in my secondhand Jetta, at the prison, I knew something about the guy I was going to speak to.
Right.
And a couple of guys complimented me on my research. It's like, hey, you've done your background on me. Because so then you can then find the contrast between what they say and what you know was done.
I want to bring Nicole Engelbrecht on because she's the co-author of this book. And I don't know which of you two came up with the idea first, but I'm sure that South Africans are going to be absolutely gripped by it. So, Nicole, first of all, congratulations on your podcasts, which have done so very well. And I think you have figured out that we're a country that is absolutely fascinated by this stuff. And the stuff you've been involved with and the kinds of investigations you've done are truly the things of like nightmares. Did you come up with the idea because you just knew South Africans would be fascinated, or are you yourself the one who's fascinated? I'm kind of curious to know that before we even get started.
Morning. Thanks so much for having me on. That's a pleasure. I think a little bit of both. You know, it's something that's a topic that I've been interested in probably most of my adult life, is sort of the true crime genre. And most definitely, you know, when I started the podcast, I figured it was going to be a hobby. But it was also really, I started it because there was nothing in the South African space telling South African stories at the time. And firstly, I figured that South African victims of violent crime really needed their own voice. And I saw what other podcasts were doing.
Right.
But I could also see that there was a demand for it. You know, I could see on YouTube channels and podcasts, South Africans asking, why don't we have something like this for South African cases?
So tell me quickly how you and Bryn got to work together. How did that happen?
So interestingly, it's actually exactly 5 years today that Bryn answered a tweet that I sent out. I found his paper online, and as I'm wont to do, I read all 600 odd pages of it because it just fascinated me. It's not common to find, you know, real research like this that's face to face with serial killers. So I was fascinated. And I thought at the time maybe we could do a podcast on it. So I tweeted him, and yeah, exactly 5 years today that he actually replied to me on Twitter. And over the last 5 years, we sort of bounced back and forth ideas about what we could do with this research, and eventually came up with the idea for the book together. I really think it was very much a joint project all along.
Robert Cunningham says in the comments, congratulations, Nicole. Super to see how you've won. It's really inspiring. That's awesome. And Bitcoin Boot says, I actually met the Modimolle monster. So you've done this incredible book about the samurai guy, this Krugersdorp dude. That was a whole other different story in terms of the level of chaos and craziness. And I think people still are fascinated by that story. Out of all the various episodes that you've covered, investigated, written about, Are there some that stick out more than others? And is it because they're just utterly brutal and revolting? Or is it because they're a little bit weird, or the person involved was psychologically a very different game than the others?
So I think the complex and, you know, like the Samurai Sword case, the ones with all the rabbit holes certainly stick out in terms of interesting facts and interesting research and that sort of thing. But I really think for me, the ones, if I look at the podcast episodes I've done, the ones that really stick with me are mostly the unsolved cases. And that's because I often have, always have contact with the families directly. And, you know, we're working together to try and get the story out there and get leads in, which has thankfully been happening on some of the cold cases. So I think those are probably the ones that stick with me. But, you know, you always have these cases where it's something unexpected happens and I'm researching and I find something and my mind is just blown. You know, so I think there's a couple of interesting cases like that, especially where you find generationally in families there's, you know, murder sort of throughout the generations or serious violent crime throughout the generations. Sure. Those are always interesting to me.
Riet says, I've listened to Nicole's podcast, True Crime South Africa, like a true fangirl. And Wayne says, Criminal Minds is a really good series on Disney Plus. The lengths they went to and trying to understand the psychology of a serial killer in order to build a profile. I mean, that's the kind of stuff that you've been doing to help investigators.
Yeah, absolutely. That was the original reason we went in, was to get to build up a database, and that database can help then profile offenders. But I do just need to say, like when Nicole tweeted me, I was impressed she read the PhD, which is, there's probably about six people in the world that have actually slogged through that, and one of them's my mom, you know. But also what I really liked was the ethical core to what she was doing in True Crime South Africa.
Yeah.
It was very much being victim-focused. It was very much about research. So when we started to bounce ideas around, I was like, actually, I've got all these audio tapes of serial murderers from 15, 20 years ago that I've never listened to. She's probably the right person I can share this with, you know, because of that ethical core and that focus on sort of being very careful about telling the right story and doing that diligence. So huge praise to Nicole.
On the matter of other investigators here, Catch Me a Killer by Mickey Pistorius, Loretta says, was brilliant. Did Bryn ever work with or learn from her?
Mickey was who I was working for when I went into the prison. So it was, Mickey was like, I needed someone to go in and help me do the research. And so, so in I went. And on Strangers on the Street, some of the source materials from the interviews I did.
Do either of you have an idea of whether or not, I mean, we know South Africa is a really tough place. Mm. You know, there are people who are really living in survival mode 24/7. That's not to say that people have more of an excuse to be serial killers and murderers, but is there any kind of unique characteristic to a South African serial murderer that we don't find anywhere else?
I did do a comparison in a previous paper between, because South Africa, I think we, and it's always hard to get precise figures because a lot of getting precise figures depends on police noticing.
Yeah.
But South Africa was sort of number two or three on the world charts, you know, USA, Russia, South Africa.
Sheesh. I don't know if we want to be on the top of that chart.
It's not a chart you really want to be topping.
But for some reason I knew the USA was on that list too.
Yeah.
But I think that, and it's really complex to understand because some of it comes down to actually just opportunity.
Mm-hmm.
So, for example, when I moved to the UK and started working in the UK police, I remember working in the South African police, chatting with a murder detective and asking, how many cases do you have, live cases, on your case file? It was like 12. And I was like, that's quite a bit. Went to the UK and was doing my basic training as an intelligence analyst. Like the number of officers they put in the first 24 hours of a murder case, one, is about 200. On a single one.
Well, you can see it whenever there is one of these murders. There was one earlier this year, and it was all over the news all the time. And we would need 200 channels in this country to be running concurrently to be able to give it the kind of attention that one got.
So some of it just comes down to resourcing and guys being caught quickly. I mean, I did find like South African serial murders. This is where, and it's partly what like helped motivate to write the book, is a lot of the stuff you hear in Hollywood just didn't chime in real life.
Yeah.
And I could hear the young Bryn on the tapes getting a little bit like worried, because I'm like, these guys aren't coming out with these deep and complex sexual fantasies.
Mm.
You know, that all the, these, you know, all the literature from America is like they've got to be harboring these things for years.
No, sometimes it's just reptile brain reactions, right?
And what I was hearing was like Sasanda going, well, I just laid, you know, if you anger me, I lay my hands on you.
Right.
And he tells himself a story that that's an okay thing to do. And that story builds. And eventually he's gone, okay, now I've killed someone. Right. I didn't mean for that to happen, but since I've done it once. That's a very, the reality is very different from the Hollywood.
I think that's what fascinates me about serial killers, because more often than not, you find out that the first time they kill someone, it's sometimes in self-defense or, as you're saying, the, you know, reptile brain reaction.
Yeah.
But was there anything in your research that kind of indicated the willingness to continue down that rabbit hole? Excuse me.
It depended on I think it sort of depended on the person.
Mm-hmm.
And, well, that interplay between the victim and... So, for example, Jacques, he got no pleasure from killing people. He's just like, well, I was raping people. And then, you know, one of my victims, I turned the light on. And she saw my face, so I shot her.
Jesus.
It was just straight elimination of witness. Others, other guys got a thrill from it and were like, actually, it's more mixed in with, you know, it's early in the morning, so hopefully no one's eating their breakfast, but, you know, it got more mixed in with sort of, well, it really turned me on. This really did. And then I would just do it again because that was great.
Nicole, what do you think it is? Because South Africans, I mean, if I think about it logically, we should have an aversion to these kinds of stories because there is so much of it around us. And yet, it appears to me that we are as interested, if not more interested, than people from anywhere else in the world where things are, in inverted commas, safer and there isn't such rampant crime. What do you think of the audiences of your podcasts and the things you've written?
You know, I think that there's probably for South Africans maybe an element of desensitization, you know, because we've been exposed to crime so often and so much, you know, there may be in consumption of this type of content, people are, you know, perhaps not seeing these as real circumstances. That may be an element of it. But for the most part, I think what I've seen is really just pure human curiosity.
Yeah.
You know, everyone at the base of this is the mystery. And then there's also this element that I've seen, you know, which I've understood exists in myself as well. And I think as in everyone consuming this type of content, where we hope to maybe find in these stories the answers to what makes us different from both the perpetrators and the victims. And that might not be the conscious reason we're consuming it, but I think that's got a lot to do with the fascination around the psychology, for instance, of the offenders, is how can I figure out, you know, I must be very different from these men and women that do these types of things. How am I different? Wow. And I think if you consume enough of this, you realize you're actually not that.
Yeah, that's that I think is probably the most terrifying thing for anybody. Is like you look at these people and some of them appear to be completely logical. Some of them are motivated by material things, which we're all motivated by on our day-to-day. You know, we're not necessarily killing people, I should hope, but we're trying to get the same things they're trying to get.
Right.
You know, whether it's money, whether it's a sense of being important. There are lots of these things and the motivators do differ, right, Bryn?
Yes, the motivators differ.
I mean, very seldom it's like, I want to kill.
Oh yeah, no, you won't have guys. And you know, I was listening before I came on. And some of the guys go to great pains to say, actually, I'm a nice person. I'm not a bad guy.
Yeah,
I just had some unfortunate circumstances, which meant I killed a bunch of people. You know, I know it sounds ridiculous when I say it like that, but
they were in the way. I was trying to get across the road, and
But what's also really interesting, and again, what inspired the book and the title of the book is like killer stories, was realizing that some of the stories these guys told themselves about themselves aren't that different from the stories so-called normal people tell themselves. You know, so for example,
I see Nicole's nodding her head. She agrees completely.
You know, so you know, for example, that victim narrative of saying, "Well, if the world's mean to me, I can definitely be cruel back."
Yeah,
it's, you know, and it's actually disturbing. Like when I was writing it, you start to hear politicians how they motivate their followers is so often by saying, "You are oppressed, so get revenge." And that is when you hear it sort of coming from serial murderers saying, well, what do you expect with life being so cruel to me?
Yeah.
Do you expect me to be nice back? And that's, you know, and that's sort of almost one of my calls to action from the book is, you know, pay attention to your stories, guys, because much as it can motivate you, it can also trap you.
Look at how these messages of you're oppressed and you're a victim are so en vogue at the moment. And you could see it spreading throughout mostly the Western world, funnily enough, the place where you would think, you know, people had the resources and the ability to conscientize themselves to the fact that they're not actually victims in history. Now's the best time for you to ever have been alive. And in societies where largely you have rights and you are protected and there is a system that can look after you. And those are the very people who seem to be falling for this victim mentality more than anyone else. But there are two points being made here in the comments that I'd like to have both you and Nicole comment on, Bryn. First one is that Bitcoin Butt says something about Nyaupe, but drugs are a big problem in South Africa. And we know a lot of killers, if they're not hooked on drugs, are certainly using them sometimes to make it easier for them to go through with some pretty horrendous deeds. Is it your finding that does play a role, or is that really just an accessory to what's going on?
From the point of view of the men I spoke to in the book, accessory at best.
Really?
Not a core motivator. I think some of, I'm just thinking through the case files as I'm speaking, is that some guys did use drugs, but sometimes, well, one of them particularly, I'm thinking Michael, used it as a way to tranquilize himself, to say, I'm struggling to deal with life. It's probably better if I'm unconscious. I know certainly, though, it's difficult to make comparisons always across countries, but in the UK, I found sort of working for the police there, drugs were a stronger element. But again, more as a material motivator. It's like, right, I'm hooked on heroin. I need money for more heroin. I'm going to steal stuff so I can get more money.
And then, Nicole, if you have a go at this one from Wayne, he says, considering we don't have the death sentence in South Africa, my assumption is that some of these convicted serial killers will be released at some point. And that is the case. Some of these people have been let out. What kinds of things do we know about what happens to them after that?
So really, you know, I guess the parole system is something that I explore in my book, Sizzlers, and it's a very important topic at the moment. When serial killers are, you know, a lot of these guys will be getting multiple life sentences when they're sentenced. And what that means in South Africa at the moment is you serve 25 years in prison, then you become eligible for parole. If the parole system works the way it should, the parole board should be looking at the fact that this is a serial offender who is very unlikely to be rehabilitated. That's usually, you know, said in court when the sentence and judgments is handed down. And that should be something the parole board considers. So really, if we're looking at a serial offender coming up for parole, if things, as I say, work the way they should, we should not be seeing these guys coming up, you know, being released easily. However, we know, you know, for instance, the man who's called the Station Strangler was recently released on parole. And right. The reason that that happened was because he was actually only convicted of one murder. So okay. In that sense, we can't actually call him a serial killer because he wasn't convicted of multiple, you know, so there the parole consideration is different. And really, you know, the fact is that we know that these guys will, there is almost 100% chance that they will reoffend. You know, in every single sentencing of these types of offenders in court, the experts, the profilers, the forensic psychologists inform the court that there is very little chance with elements of psychopathy and sociopathy that these offenders will ever reoffend. So it is extremely dangerous to let out guys like this onto the streets. And sadly, our parole system isn't set up to watch them either. So especially if there's sexual elements involved.
Well, you've answered two questions in one there, because people are also asking about the definition of a serial killer. So that was perfect. Yeah. Just one other quick thing I want to ask you, Bryn, because we only have a couple of minutes left. But this idea that people who murder must be mentally ill. I mean, we're learning so much more about mental illness along the way. We're learning that there are different kinds of mental illness. There are different sort of disorders. There are some that are more antisocial than others. But the idea that people want to create a category of mental illness for murderers is really just society trying to abdicate responsibility for the problem. There have always been murderers. They're not all mentally ill. Mm-hmm. Sometimes society takes those people and uses them in armies or in gangs or wherever else. And there is probably a proportion of us, and you can't say them because we're all included. This is humanity. There's probably a proportion of us who are just okay with ending other of us's lives.
Well, you know what?
It's a horrible thought, but we got to deal with it, right?
It's absolutely true. And there's been studies that have shown there's higher levels of psychopathy in certain medical professions. Apparently, apologies if there's any brain surgeons watching, quite high in brain surgery. Because you need a certain coolness emotionally to be able to cut into someone else's head meat, you know. So, and I think you hit the nail on the head, is that as a society, we do abdicate responsibility when we categorize everyone as over there. And similarly, we abdicate responsibility when we condemn someone who might have murdered to eternal damnation without any hope of redemption. Because actually, we are then saying there's certain people that... you know, if you do a certain bad thing, we will definitely sort of chuck you away forever. The book ends with the example of someone, because all the stories in the book, the story didn't end well.
Yeah.
And I was saying, is that really what we want to say about the role
and, your story's you're not playing? Talking about the victims now, you're talking about the actual murderers.
The actual murderers. Right. It ended up in prison. You had a bad story. It got worse. Your life went, you know, down the pan, you're locked away forever. And again, thanks to Nicole, finding someone who did commit murders, but then over the course of 20 years started completely retelling his story. It's an incredible journey, and I can't do it justice in the time we have.
Redemptive?
Absolutely. And not soft redemption, because I can already see Jack's face going, I don't know about that.
Yeah.
Not in the case of...
Jack's like, just chucked him in the pile.
But this guy, what was so interesting is he was merciless on himself about what he did. He apologized to every single person he hurt. And then he apologized to the family. Then he apologized to the town. And then he said, and even then he said, I'm going to die in prison. I'm never coming out. So now, you know, my job is to work for charities to raise funds for the people I hurt outside. Sure. So, and I don't know if I said in the book, he was like, I don't trust people's words. You know, they need the words, but then they need to act.
Mm-hmm.
And then I think it's that possibility of redemption, which again, society needs to pay attention to, because we can be lazy and doom people, or we can do what we should and sort of hold people to account, but then allow that possibility that people can rejoin the fold.
I just wanted to find out from you and Nicole, on a personal level, like having to deal with these kind of things, it's that's no walk in the park. I mean, you're talking to murderers, like serial murderers. Separating yourself from what you hear to the point whereby it doesn't, you know, give you nightmares and all
you
of this stuff.
You don't sit at home and see something pass like, the window and you know, shit yourself.
Or look at people in a suspicious way. Like, okay, that guy kind of is exhibiting a few traits that I saw when I was, you know what I mean? How do you guys separate your work from your personal life?
Well, I'll pass to Nicole in a second, because Nicole's podcast is a lot of dealing with cases.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, for me, it's always been you focus on the job, and then when you've done the job, you separate yourself from that. But you do become very aware, and when I was working in the police, you become very aware that, you know, beneath everyday society, there's a whole underworld of crazy stuff going on.
Mm.
But that is part of the appeal of it. And I think also that's why people often feel appealed to true crime, is you want that glimpse into that safe glimpse into the underworld.
Mm.
And then you can come back to your everyday life.
Okay. Nicole, how about you?
Yeah, I think so. I talk a bit in the book about how when I first started doing this and people asked me this question, I felt like I might be a bit of a psychopath myself, because I didn't feel like I was having this negative, this material wasn't having this negative effect on me that everyone else said it would. And, you know, over the years, my understanding of why that is has developed and changed. You know, personally, I think I'm very emotionally resilient. I've also learned to compartmentalize, which is what Bryn was speaking about, sort of putting, you know, the work in a box and then being able to focus on what you're doing. I think for me, I've been very lucky in the way that I've been able to focus on sort of the positive things that I'm getting out of this work. Firstly, helping to bring in, you know, leads on cold cases, telling the stories of victims of violent crime, but also just my personal knowledge that I've gained throughout the years and how I've changed as a human being in really becoming more empathetic, understanding how, you know, there's a very thin line between so-called good and so-called bad. Mm. And I think the more that I sort of cling to those positives that are coming out of it, the easier it is for me to cope with what is, you know, let's face it, really traumatic and terrible material on a daily basis.
Well, I'm going to congratulate you both again on this book. It is called Killer Stories. There it is. You can see it in front of Bryn. Killer Stories, Conversations with South African Serial Murderers. The authors, Bryn Hodgkiss and Nicole Engelbrecht, joining us this morning on the show. Well done. I wish you luck. I think there are going to be loads of people who are going to be absolutely engrossed in this book and these conversations. So thank you for writing it.
And thank you so much for inviting me on. And I saw in the chat there's a couple of book launches coming up, so keep an eye on the social media.
But absolutely.
Thank you again. It's been a real pleasure.
I think you guys have also obviously put the fear of God into me now, because you didn't tell me how I can identify a serial killer. So I'm just going to assume everybody is.
And now we're going to have to get the book.
Until they prove otherwise. Yeah.
We're going to have to get the book.
All right. Very good. So thanks, guys. We'll be back in a moment or two with a whole lot more. Jack Mutlante and I, and then we've got a discussion about hopefully something very, very different, because I don't think it has to do with serial killers, but does have to do with conscious leadership. Now, I mean, I don't have to tell you that there are loads and loads of people who occupy offices, who've done things, who seem to be the kind of people we should look to as leaders, who are actually just office bearers, and who, frankly, I'm mostly unimpressed with. But we'll find out from Dr. Pepe Marais and from Gareth Van Vieren what exactly they think conscious leadership is all about. That's coming up next, plus a bunch of other fun stuff. Don't go anywhere.